Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Thought Grenades with Robert Thompson and Mike Neese on Blog Talk Radio. Robert is the author of The Offsite, Leadership Challenge Fable, and the founder of LeaderInsideOut.com.
And welcome once again to Thought Grenades with Robert Thompson and co-host Mike Neese. This is Monday, February 9, 2015. And this is, of course, Robert Thompson coming to you live from the beautiful San Francisco Bay, as we do each and every Monday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time. And as always, joining me from the shores of frozen, or no, that's Lake Michigan, sorry, is my good friend and co-host, Mike Neese. Mike, how are you today?
I am well, and it is indeed frozen, so it happens every year this time.
All right. So you're used to it. Yeah, we got a little rain out here this weekend in California, so it's not going to end the drought, but we appreciate it. So we've got a great show once again today. Mike Butler, Chief of Safety for Longmont, Colorado, joins us to kick off our first installment of what we're calling Leadership for the Common Good, a theme that we're going to be focusing on for the next few months. We hope you enjoy how we're going to put all this together. Chief Butler will share insights around restorative justice. What is it? How did it help Longmont overcome serious issues in their community? Could restorative justice have helped solve problems in Ferguson, New York City? Those are just two of the many questions on our mind. Restorative justice is the topic we'll tackle this week as we begin this new series that looks at real leaders solving real problems in real time. And we're glad that you joined us. Folks, if you have a question or a thought you'd like to share, please call in 347-989-0965, 347-989-0965. And, of course, don't miss a session by subscribing to Thought Grenades on iTunes. That way Mike and I are right there on your mobile device. If you're looking for something practical, simple, and effective, and actually very real, stay right here. Mike Butler, it's good to have you on. Thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Or maybe I should refer to you as Chief so we don't confuse my co-host. He'll start answering your questions. And we also have Peter Block on the line. Peter is a colleague that has brought Mike to the show. Peter, it's good to have you here.
Thanks. Good to be here.
All right.
Mike is amazing. He's always up for, head of safety. Mike's been doing community building for years, so it's great to be on.
And so now the expectations even higher. So, Chief Butler, tell us a little bit, give us a little background on restorative justice. As Mike and I were doing our research, we learned more and more about it. I'm familiar with it, but perhaps some of our listeners are not. Can you give us a little brief description of what you've been doing in Longmont with this restorative justice?
You bet. First of all, the principles of restorative justice have been around for a long, long time. The application of restorative justice is merely a mechanism or structure in which these principles can be manifested. The basic principles are one of relationship, respect, repair, responsibility, and reintegration. And we started utilizing these principles through the application of restorative justice with our crime and disorder issues in our community. And basically, the ongoing traditional response to crime has been to invoke the criminal justice system to arrest people, to summons people, to prosecute people, and to see where it goes from there. And so restorative justice takes on a much more personable approach. It brings about chosen accountability. It brings about empathy. It brings about long-term relationships. It repairs those relationships that happened through the crime. And so practically speaking, how it works is let someone commits a harm against somebody else. Our police officers are part of the interaction at this point, and they have options. They can either arrest somebody, summon somebody, or refer somebody to restorative justice. And the number of referrals have dramatically increased over the years. In fact, and I'll get into what it looks like, but we're over 3,500 cases in this community of around 95,000 people. And so that's over a period of almost 20 years. But what happens is if someone does commit a harm, we'll ask the offender whether or not they're interested in being part of a process in which they engage with the person who has been harmed. Often those people are referred to as offenders and victims. Those people come together with their support groups, with trained facilitators, and with representatives in the community who then work through what happened, what was the harm, and how it impacted people. What are the assets and strengths that we can bring into play in terms of how we move forward with reintegration? There is a contract put in place that the person who committed the harm has to complete. And so the victim has a significant role in this process. Members of the community get to discuss how the harm impacted them and their community. The person who committed the harm has to choose responsibility and accountability in terms of being able to move forward. And so all those dynamics are in play. And what we have found through these principles and the application of restorative justice, that the recidivism rate, the people who the amount of times people are actually recontacted by the police is less than 10%. In the criminal justice system, it's closer to 70%. And so we believe that the powers that are out there that come through restorative justice are really powerful, and they have long-term sustainable impact and effect on the people involved in the process itself. We work with all kinds of crime. We work with misdemeanors. We work with felonies. We work with people under the age of 18, adults. We work with people who have been in the system several times or never been in the system. And so this basically is just a coming together of people to talk about what happened, why it happened, the harms that were committed, how the harms impact people, and then to work on a reintegration process in which people, everyone in the room is part of that process. And so it's, like I said, it's not a new philosophy, or these are not necessarily new concepts, but they're concepts that have been kind of worked through the restorative justice process. And I just also want to say that these restorative principles can be applied in many different environments. Anywhere where there's two people, they can be applied. With workplaces, we've used the restorative process in our disciplinary cases and conflict resolution cases. There's actually a task force, a statewide task force right now that's working on how to build restorative communities in which communities can begin to take on these principles and in a variety of venues and environments bring that those kinds of dynamics to life between and amongst people. I'll stop there.
So you're also the chief of safety in Longmont, which means you're also the fire chief, which I just felt like you just gave us a fire hose of information. And so I want to drill back a little bit because this is awesome information. I mean, it is just something that is necessary to get out into to everywhere. Are there, let's go to the first one that I have. You mentioned when an officer shows up at the scene of what you're calling a harm, which most people would say was a crime, right? Something happened. Do they have the ability, the officer is trained to then work out restorative principles there, or do they have to arrest and then it's taken care of under a restorative basis?
Well, there's no, we don't invoke the criminal justice system if we choose to send something to the restorative justice process. Oftentimes,
so right then and there, the officer can do that.
Well, actually, there's a referral made to a service group called our Longmont Community Justice Partnership that brings in the facilitators and works through these cases, brings people into the room. That's the process that the officer refers to. But I will also say that our officers, every one of our officers, have been comprehensively trained in the principles of restorative justice and how they apply. And they can actually work out circumstances on scene if the situation kind of says that's the way it should go. All of these are situational, circumstantial, but the point of all of this is that we have this process in this community that is very well accepted from our elected officials, from our police department, and from a significant base of our community. But it's taken a long time for us to get it to that point. But yes, our officers, and we've reached what I call a tipping point within our police services division, in which our officers are all very accepting of the process of restorative justice. In fact, we've seen people, our officers, go from this will never work to becoming ambassadors for restorative justice throughout the state of Colorado and around the nation. So they understand and they see the results. And one of the things that impacts our police officers is, number one, that the victim seems to have a voice that counts. And number two, that the person who's committed the harm or the crime chooses accountability so that the officer never sees that person again. And so we're seeing those results. And I also have to say, one of the results, the restorative justice process has been a major impact in terms of our community being one of the safest communities in the state of Colorado because the recidivism rates are so low.
That's fabulous.
Wow.
Yeah, this is Mike. To follow up on what Robert asked, though, if I understood how this actually rolls out, the offender is given a choice to enter this process. Is that correct?
It has to be voluntary on the part of the person who's committed the crime, and it has to be voluntary on the part of the person who's the victim of the crime. And our officers work with those folks at that point in time and to encourage them, if the circumstances are where they need to be, to encourage them to go down that restorative justice path, yes.
Why wouldn't an offender choose this?
No, offenders normally would. We normally don't have to sell a lot of that to our offender. They understand that there'll be no record, there'll be no arrest, and maybe they don't know exactly what they're in for, but because to work, to be in that conference with the victim, members of the community, and others is not necessarily an easy thing to do. Many people might see this as relatively soft or fuzzy or letting people off, but what we find is that when people do in fact choose responsibility and they have to admit to what they did and why they did it and the impact it's had on people, that's a difficult thing for people to do. And they don't get that opportunity necessarily in the criminal justice system. And so because they go through this process, I think there's an internalized rewiring that happens for people who go through that process. And they end up becoming, they understand the connections they have to the victim. They understand the connection they have to the larger community. And frankly, I think their perspective around who they are in the community is truly enhanced.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting when Peter asked why wouldn't the offender choose it, because I was actually thinking of it the other way, Mike, and it would seem to me to be a bit harder sell to the victim rather than the offender. Have you seen that?
Yes, I mean, if we're working with people at that point in time who are perhaps the most, there's potential for trauma. There's potential for really feeling like they're in crisis. And certainly the person, the offender, may have some defensiveness going for them. And so our officers are trained to work through those dynamics and work to help people understand that there's another option here that will perhaps serve them for a longer level of time than just being transferred right into the criminal justice system.
That's great.
I have so many questions. It's I've got the fire hose now. I think you mentioned that the principles have been around and the process has been around for a while, and our research shows roughly the early or mid 90s or so, 97. This fellow by the name of Howard Zayer evidently is the pioneer, but I guess it goes back beyond that. Also, that this is an international activity, that other countries are doing this. In fact, Norway used restorative justice for the fellow that killed 77 people. I was a little shocked with that. So I'm sure that if I'm shocked with that, then there's a bunch of people out there that are, very much more punitive oriented than I am, that are even more shocked. But I go back to the process itself that you're using there in Longmont. Who are the facilitators? Are they judges? Or are they just like Mike and I? Or
one of the beauties of this is that we train community members to do this. this is where the capacity of our community rises to a significant level in terms of being involved in the solving of community-wide issues. We take everyday community members and train them to be facilitators and also train them to be community representatives in these conferences. And we've literally had thousands of community members be a part of that. And so these are people who volunteer, step up. And when we talk about social or human or community capital, this is a great example of where people, you know, not attached to the system in any way, shape, or form, can be a part of bringing to this community a new level of accountability, a new level of empathy, and being part of a process that makes a big difference.
Right. And, of course, a question also on in your jails. Are you using these principles within the jails once people are incarcerated? Are the people, the officers in the jail system itself, trained with these principles so that they can sort of plant some seeds with the folks that are incarcerated?
Well, let me just say that as a municipal government, we don't oversee any kind of corrections facilities. We have a Boulder County jail that oversees serves Longmont, and we have the Colorado Department of Corrections. It has limited use. It's been used limitedly, I think, in the corrections facilities. There are anecdotal situations, and there are actually some people in Colorado that are going into prisons and connecting people who have been victimized by crime and the people who are in jail who committed the crime. There are a number of examples throughout the last 20, 25 years where victims of families who have had family members murdered have actually sat down with people who had murdered their loved ones and have worked through this process. But it doesn't necessarily do anything in terms of the offender doesn't necessarily that's not a get-out-of-jail-free card or anything like that. It's just a process where two people and families can come together and work out a lot of needs and bring a lot of closure to things that have been happening to them emotionally and spiritually. And so it is a process, as I said before, that can be used anywhere. It's also a process that can be used to complement what happens in the criminal justice system. I would bet that person in Norway didn't escape the consequences of what happened in terms of being incarcerated, but had the opportunity to work with families and that were victims or whose family members were victims. And so I would imagine that complemented the system and was not in lieu of the system.
Right. No, the news there was he would probably never be released from jail, but he was only sentenced to 21 years. And so people were somewhat shocked, but the folks that understand the restorative justice process weren't shocked. Because they knew that there would be other issues that would keep him incarcerated. But it was the victims' families that were able to release some of the pent-up stress, frustration, anguish, and pain that they had. So it
certainly
worked for them. We both, in fact, Mike and I both, and without direction, we watched another TEDx, this fellow by the name of Daniel Riesel. And he talked about the neurological cause of crime and can it be cured. And he was focusing on the amygdala and so on and so forth. And he sort of shared that because of this process, you can cure this if you can get people moving in the right direction, that the brain does heal. That's a whole different topic, but it just shows that there's many other ways to approach it other than seeking retribution on someone. Some of our listeners are facilitators in their own right, Mike. Is there a place where they can go be trained to become a part of this or in their community, or is there someone training people in this other than you, or what's the plan there?
Yes, the Longmont Community Justice Partnership, which is a nonprofit in our community, facilitates all of that training. And they have people who have the skill sets to train our community members to become facilitators in these conferences. And so that's where those skill sets are learned. And so it's not something we do within our police or public safety. It's something that our Longmont Community Justice Partnership oversees. Let me also go back and say that there's a tremendous amount of research being done in the arena of neuroscience that is clearly pointing to people's environments changing and the hardwiring in their brain changing as a result of the environment. And that's becoming more and more, I think, evident through the science of, or through neuroscience research. And we're seeing the restorative process takes into account that, you know, people who have committed crimes and harms, you know, when they see that they're embraced by the sense of forgiveness, the sense of love, the sense of care, the sense of belonging that they now feel, that we can't sit here and point to it. And I haven't seen that TEDx on that neurological study, but it totally resonates with me that that is entirely possible, and that's why the recidivism rates are so low.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that's his whole premise, is the environment shapes that. Mike, you had a thought or to share?
No, I just wanted to mention the Longmont Community Justice Partnership. Their website, lcjp.org, has a lot of the information there, and I thought to make sure we give that a plug as well.
Thank you.
Can I ask Mike a question? This is Peter.
Go ahead, Peter.
Mike, I imagine you've given lots of talks about this to the law enforcement world. And how does that go? You know, it seems to me that the police are under such fire all the time. And you've been doing this 20-plus years, so you have some credibility, you know. And, talk about that a little bit.
Why isn't this an
answer to Ferguson?
I'm not saying it can't be. I think there's more issues going on in Ferguson than perhaps that are underlying, but perhaps for another discussion for another day. I will say that it's a slow process. I'm doing a presentation next week to all the Colorado police chiefs, and this is going to be one of the things that I'm going to be speaking to, plus the whole dynamic and concept of belonging. And how do we build enduring trust in our communities, and that the police and fire departments can have legitimate platforms to become ambassadors for building that sense of belonging or building that sense of thinking restoratively, and that we have these opportunities right now, maybe born out of Ferguson and born out of New York and other places where, you know, I think the police profession and service is not a crossroads. And that crossroads is, who are we? And what is our role? And are we no longer, nor should we be referred to as that thin blue line. I think we can be fulcrums. We can be people who have leverage to bring about that kind of social, human, and community capital. And those are the presentations I've been giving and around our community, the other police chiefs, and that's what I've said on a statewide and national level as well, and that there's a great time for us at this point, as we have been kind of under the microscope, to redefine and retool and reskill set ourselves in a way that we can become those fulcrums, and we can become that leveraging capacity, and we've seen that here in Longmont. We have people want data. Well, we have data. And people want a sense of, well, how did that work? Well, we can show them how it worked. And are there formulas? Yeah, there are formulas out there, but each community needs to figure that out. So it's a slow process, but I think it's a ripe time for our profession, the policing and public safety and fire included, I think, to see as an opportunity and as a possibility.
You know, one of my friends and colleagues runs an academy in Santa Clara County in California, creating police and fire. And if restorative justice is not a topic within the curriculum, it should be. Mike, you know, you're very passionate about this. You've got, as you say, you have the data, you have the experience, you've been using this for a long time. What brought you to it? What triggered this? Why did you embrace this? How did you come in contact with it and then become such a passionate leader in it?
Well, this is a wonderful time to talk about a great person that introduced it to me. Her name is Dr. Beverly Tidal. I will just say, unfortunately, she passed away last year from a long battle with cancer. But, you know, we were already somewhat predisposed in our organization in terms of working through the concepts of community policing. Our motto is policing in partnership with the people. And any time that we could bring about a level of partnership where there's that sense of accountability shared by all and that people have these opportunities to make a difference, we were ripe for that. I will also say that Peter Block, you know, Peter's work, his book on stewardship, his book on community, building a structure of belonging, are all books that connected a lot of dots for me, crystallized a lot of fragments. And so we were more or less ripe to hear this. And so when the idea came along, it was almost like the ground was fertile, and we were ready to plant those seeds and grow it from there. And that's there's a long story, folks, in terms of the start to here to where we're at. But it's a story I think that we think is worth telling, and so we appreciate the opportunity.
So we appreciate that you would take the time to be with us. And, of course, Peter being here, it's always good for an author to know firsthand why some of the work that they've done has impacted far more than you know, just a few people in the leadership field. And this is where, you know, Mike and I are both aiming now for the next few months to see what we can do. Our goal with Leadership for the Common Good is to be able to bring this awareness, what your activities are, to help people build a connection and then get them engaged. And, of course, Mike mentioned, you know, he threw out a little shout-out to your folks there in Longmont. Are there some other websites or something that people can go to, some of our listeners, or they can send their colleagues to? Can you give us some links that people can
get? I think if you Google restorative principles, practices, or restorative justice, it'll take you to more than enough websites to get a better understanding of the concept and the application. I also want to make it really clear that the restorative principles that I spoke about, those are the ones that are playing out in the application of restorative justice, but they work anywhere. And we've seen great impacts in our own public safety department with conflict resolution and cases where we would normally have applied discipline, bringing people together to work out the harms and how we move forward with a reintegration process. It can work anywhere and in any environment. And so I just want to make sure that that's out there as well.
Well said.
You know, you might say this.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I know a lot is being done in schools. You know, all of our public institutions are ripe for a restorative versus a retributive set of principles. And I really think if you talk about the common good, the common brown, this is the people say, well, what's the methodology? How do you get this? And what Mike represents, I just think is a huge opening for us to restore the common.
And let me just say, we've actually activated in our schools. So
good.
The school
good,
system
yeah.
has
and
changed their disciplinary
open,
process to become more restorative. So.
As I mentioned, it's out here in Oakland, California, too. And I'm sure in other places. We're going to go long, folks that are listening live. We're going to go long, so you'll have to catch the total end here. And I want to make sure, Mike, that you have an opportunity to share a little bit about your name before the show. You're calling it Belonging Revolution there in Longmont. Talk a little, you know, be brief, but talk a little bit about what Belonging Revolution is about and how you're doing this.
Well, so first of all, we're kind of operating from a perspective of there tends to be in every community a fairly high level of disconnectedness and isolation, and people tend to operate in little containers and for a variety of reasons. And so we believe that one of the things that we can do is to figure out how we can connect more people and figure out how we can create environments where people feel more comfortable and safe to to have their voice heard and to be a part of something larger than themselves. And so since July of last year, I asked a friend of mine, Dan Benavides, to join me on walks through neighborhoods. And so we've walked through many neighborhoods in Longmont over the last several months. The neighborhoods we have chosen so far are the poorest neighborhoods in our community, and where the minority populations live, and where the language is predominantly Spanish. And we've been spending hours and hours in every single neighborhood meeting people and asking questions. And to what level do people feel welcome? To what level do people feel invited? To what level is their sense of safety? What does that look for them? How do they feel about our community? With our minority communities, we talk about discrimination, what that looks like, if there's anything there for them. And then we provide them opportunities to get involved in the larger community. And I give my card to every single person and say, call me, and let them know that they're important, and let them know that we want them to have that sense of belonging, that sense that they're welcomed. And it's really been a remarkable experience. We walked in a neighborhood, a mobile home park yesterday, maybe 300 mobile homes, and the conversations we had were just amazing. And people really connected. I mean, and what we found is we're also trying to connect different cultures in those neighborhoods. There's African American, there's Latino, there's Caribbean cultures, and we've taken the time to figure out how we can work with those cultures as well. So it's the beginning of something that we've entitled the Belonging Revolution. What I can't sit here and say is where it's going to go. This is something that's totally heart oriented. We haven't established systems or structures or mechanisms yet. Maybe we will down the road, but we're also letting people know that this is something that we believe that can build that kind of human or social capital, or however you want to call that. So, you know, in Peter's phrases, I like what Peter says, is, you know, those folks who are marginalized, and getting them to understand, or giving them an opportunity to feel and believe that they can make a difference. And so that's why we've been spending, we haven't run across the person yet who owns a house. And so we've been spending our time in those neighborhoods talking with people who frankly don't have a lot, but feel somewhat disconnected and isolated, language barriers, cultural barriers, and working through those things so that their sense of belonging is more realized. And there's more things to come. We're going to hit many of these neighborhoods again, but in a very short period of time here, in terms of trying to explain this, that's what it looks like.
Yeah, we're going to have to leave it there, but that's a good place to leave it. We'd love to have you back, Mike, from time to time, if we can call on you for that, and to also touch base with you as we move forward with leadership and the common good, to get your feedback on various things that we're doing. So we do appreciate you taking the time to be with us, and thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks. Thanks, Mike.
See you later.
Robert, and great to hear you, Mike. Take care.
Mike Neese, again, leaders, real leaders doing real things in real time.
Mm-hmm.
Very refreshing. Folks, join us next week as we bring out another leader who is also solving real problems in real time. This is Robert Thompson for Mike Neese. Thanks for listening to Thought Grenades for Monday, February 9th, 2015.
Thanks for listening to Thought Grenades with Robert Thompson and Mike Neese. Catch us live every Monday at 10 a.m. Pacific on Blog Talk Radio, or listen anytime you wish on iTunes.